I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Since February, a Kansas City tenants group has fought for safe and affordable housing for all. Now they've drafted a tenant bill of rights, and they're gearing up to present it to City Council. It's a move they're calling historic. Today, we'll find out what the bill hopes to address and discuss its chances for approval. The organization has already gotten support from Mayor Lucas and several council members. Then, we see construction all the time, whether it's a new overpass or new apartments. But is all growth progress? We'll learn about development that is fiscally responsible and resilient. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The premise of the group Kansas City Tenants from the get-go has been that while nearly half of the city residents rent, the city fails to protect renters from a host of problems that only begin with clean and safe units and abusive landlords. The group will take a major step on Thursday when it introduces a KC Tenants Bill of Rights that is to include funding for lawyers and mediation for tenants in a landlord-tenant court. It'll also establish and fund an office for the tenant advocate. The Bill of Rights will be heard by the City Council's Housing Committee on November 6th. Here to tell us what all this is are two members of Kansas City Tenants. Tara Raghuveer is a director of KC Tenants. Tara, nice to have you back again. Welcome.
Thanks, Steve.
Tiana Caldwell is a tenant leader for the organization. Tiana, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks.
Well, how big a step is this for your organization, Tara? How do you regard it?
This is a huge step for our organization.
Yes.
As you know, Steve, we started organizing back in February with about 12 people at our first Saturday meeting. And weekly since then, we've met, and our numbers are now in the 60s every Saturday for 2 hours. And for the past few months, we've spent that time drafting our tenant bill of rights. We organized in the spring to get the new city council and mayor committed to this idea. And then we took the time to write a bill of rights that reflects our needs and our experience. And now we're going to see that realized. It's not everything we need, but it's a good step today so that we can set ourselves up for more wins for tenants in the future.
And we'll talk more in detail about the Bill of Rights as we go along here, Tara. But what is it? What is the KC Tenants Bill of Rights?
So it's actually a package. It's not just one document. There is one resolution, which is the overall Bill of Rights. And what that does is it accounts for the existing rights in municipal code that tenants have, but sadly are not enforced very well. And it also accounts for the rights that we hope to establish. The second piece of our package is a resolution that establishes the right to counsel and mediation for tenants who earn under 200% of the federal poverty line. And the third, as you mentioned, is an ordinance that establishes an office of the tenant advocate. And the duties of that office include educating tenants on their rights, investigating rights violations, and then enforcing the rights, including revoking landlord licenses if they violate tenant rights.
So this really puts some muscle behind what your organization has been about for all these different months, right?
That's right. That's right. And every piece of our package, I think this is critical, every piece of our Tenant Bill of Rights package is connected to a story of a leader in our base. So really, this is about bringing justice to people who have already been wronged, and they needed this package of tenant rights yesterday.
Tiana, your group has been aiming for this moment for how long here?
We began organizing a meeting in February. Like she said, I was in contact with her before that in anticipation and looking forward to building KC Tenants in our base. I'm directly impacted by it. The past evictions, discrimination was really big for me and my family. After I got diagnosed with cancer the second time, we were evicted. That's like a scarlet letter when you're here and you're trying to get into a place. So me and my family.
I was going to say, once you're evicted once, getting another place is really difficult.
Yeah, because doesn't matter the reason.
A landlord will see an eviction on your record and you're in tough shape.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I'm not the only one. And then, you know, the health department stepped in with the place that I was able to get. I just had to pay double deposit. And some other things. We didn't mind. You know, we had the income. And then there was the sewage backed up the first night that we had showers. And so the health department stepped in and, yeah, you know, this was a problem. You guys can't be here. This is unsafe. It's not sanitary. But it becomes a displacement. You know, I was already there because I didn't have anywhere to go, or I wasn't, or I was being discriminated against on applications for housing anyway. So, you know, living in hotels and on couches for 5 to 6 months, this is really rough, especially when you're sick.
Yeah. Tara, you know, Tiana's story, you've heard this kind of thing in this town over and over and over again, right?
We hear it every weekend at our meetings, every door that we knock, every conversation that we have at events in town. And what I think is so powerful about our group is that we don't just sit around telling these stories and feeling bad for ourselves. We've actually practiced translating private pain into public power. And I think you saw that in the spring when we brought our folks in droves, you know, 40 deep to every city council forum, every mayoral forum. And we just started telling our stories, whether or not we were invited to. And it was that storytelling that prioritized the voices of the people who are directly impacted that shifted the political discourse in this town. It was no longer appropriate to spend a whole forum talking about potholes and trash when there were people in the room telling their own stories and demanding answers.
Do other cities have a Bill of Rights for tenants? Is this unusual what Kansas City's doing?
This will be historic for Kansas City. It will make us a regional and national leader. Our aim is to make Kansas City the best place to be a tenant in the country.
But other cities do this, right?
Other cities have bills of rights. They vary in terms of what they contain and how well they're actually enforced. So we've studied, for example, Washington, D.C. has a bill of rights, and they have an office of the tenant advocate. Their office of the tenant advocate, though, does not have the power that we're seeking in ours, which is the power to actually enforce the rights by revoking landlord licenses if they are violated. And then, of course, there are many other cities and states that are much more progressive than us in terms of tenant protections at the state level. Actually, our starting point is way behind most of the states in the country. Missouri is one of the worst states to be a renter across the country.
Mm-hmm. You know, this comes on the heels of the city not too long ago adopting this rental inspection program. It's called Healthy Homes, that the Star's editorial board has described as an unqualified success. How does your group regard that, and how effective has that program been? Does that mitigate the need for this Bill of Rights at all?
It doesn't mitigate it at all. In fact, we looked at Healthy Homes as a really positive starting point as we imagine what more of this needs to look like. So currently, the health department under Healthy Homes is the one place in the city with the authority to actually hold landlords accountable if they violate tenant rights when it comes to the habitability of their units. But we know that some rights violations are not health department jurisdiction. Right? So those, the accountability for those need to live elsewhere. Healthy Homes, I think broadly, is a great program. And as Tiana spoke to, they have helped serve justice in cases like hers. The truth is, though, Steve, if people like Tiana are displaced because their place is deemed uninhabitable, they don't have anywhere to go. And they're just put in a more desperate situation, potentially renting from an even worse landlord.
So Tiana, to what extent does this change the ball game for renters in Kansas City? If this Bill of Rights goes through, the city council adopts it in the weeks to come, how does that change the paradigm for renters in this community?
It's not going to change the system overnight. You know, that's what we're looking at. But it does give some immediate relief to renters all over the city, like Rob in our base, who has been discriminated against because of his past arrest and conviction and not able to find housing. He's leaving the house every morning, having to check his cell 15 minutes every day before he walks out the door for bed bugs. Mm-hmm. His kids can't stay at his house. Also, Simone, another one. Both of these people will be speaking at our rally. Simone, who has no problem paying her rent with her disability check, but is being discriminated by her landlord, not only for her disability and not working, but because of her gender identity and expression. You know, these are people, right? This is a human right. It should not be people out on the street. It's unhealthy. It's unsafe. You know, we're literally talking about life or death. So it's not going to change the system overnight, but it does set up some immediate reliefs for people who are dealing with this immediate danger in their lives, these immediate situations. It gives us a chance to do today gives us what we do what we can today so that tomorrow we can do what we couldn't do today.
But Tara, I want to be real clear here, because this obviously can be a two-way street. I mean, not every renter is an angel who pays rent on time and doesn't throw a party in the weekend that does damage to the unit. Landlords will surely say this is only half the story. And I'm wondering, to what extent have landlords been involved in this process of a KC tenant's Bill of Rights to make sure this is fair and square from their point of view?
So I think, first of all, you know, of course, in any relationship, there are two sides.
That's right.
Landlords are disproportionately prioritized by policy. Property owners in this country are disproportionately prioritized by policy. We see an Office of the Tenant Advocate as something like a consumer protection agency, right? If the business owner or the seller of goods is disproportionately prioritized by policy, the way you even that scale is by protecting the consumer with an Office of Consumer Protections, right? So we see this as an evening of the scales and the balance of power in Kansas City. The truth just is, renters are lower income, they're black and brown, they're people who are politically disenfranchised, right? So that's the first point I want to make. To your question, though, about whether landlords have been involved, we actually have had a couple landlords who have been coming to our meetings weekly. There's a woman named Janice who is a landlord. She's not a big landlord. She owns a couple properties, and she was previously a renter, right? So she relates to the experiences of people in the room, and her theory is that if you can't be a decent landlord, you shouldn't be a landlord. And what we're asking for in Janice's eyes is not ridiculous. It's not radical. It's just the basic things that our people are owed.
Okay. Our phone number here as we talk about a Kansas City Tenants Bill of Rights, 816-235-2888. If you have questions, or you can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, it strikes me here, Tiana, that one of the big issues as you guys go forward is simply getting the word out to renters that you have these protections built into the law. If, in fact, the city council goes along with all this, how are you going to try to deal with that part of this equation?
I think it's about, we've been organizing against just that. You know, we are knocking on doors. We are engaging people.
The word's getting out, you're saying.
Yeah, our whole base is built on that sort of people power. You know, meeting people where they're at, having a conversation, sharing something personal. So we are like connected in this relationship with each other so that we can stand together at the time that we need to and hold people accountable. And you have to have the numbers for that. So we build those relationships so that our numbers meet that demand and that we get things changed.
And again, word's getting out, you think?
Yes.
People are going to be aware of this?
People can see you in a shirt and come up and ask you questions. I mean, it happens to me daily. We are willing to talk about it. We're very passionate about getting out there. We've knocked on, I can't even say how many doors, but I know we're out there all the time. I know that people see us and they want to know what's going on. They recognize the bull on our shirts and nothing. They've heard of KC Tenants. They want to know more. And we're just willing to talk. We're willing to make those relationships, make those connections.
So, Tara, if one of my sons rents a unit here in the years to come in Kansas City, will anything be presented to one of them to sort of so they know what their rights are? Is that going to be part of this?
One of the things that we're asking for in our Tenant Bill of Rights package is that at the time of presenting a lease, the landlord is required to present also the Tenant Bill of Rights. And part of the mechanism here of putting forward a Bill of Rights, even though that's kind of the most symbolic and least substantial part of our package, is that tenants just need a place where they could Google, I'm a tenant in Kansas City, and I need to know what my rights are. And it should be the city's responsibility to put that up online, to translate that into 150 different languages and make sure that it's accessible to tenants. And KC Tenants has a role to play, no doubt. As Tiana said, we will be organizing, we'll be knocking on doors, and we'll be making sure that tenants are educated about their rights. What we know is that the win, getting this through City Council, is not actually the win. That is not when our folks' lives materially begin to change. The win is when our package passes it's fully funded and the enforcement begins and people actually know about their rights and are able to see a path to get them enforced.
I want to talk about some of those details here in just a moment, but what are the prospects for your proposals passing the city council? Because you are really tilting the balance of power here against a pretty powerful block in this community, which are landlords who make political donations and have money.
We're optimistic. I think this is a lot of what grew out of the strategy that we employed this spring, where we personalized and polarized around the issue of housing like never before in the city election. We ended up moving a lot of the current city council people and the current mayor much more in our direction than they had ever been. And now we have a fresh council, fresh faces, and we've got some potential champions there. We've been meeting for the better part of 2 months with those potential champions. We think we've got the votes. Also, the mayor has committed to us a week out from the election. He said he wanted his legacy to be housing, not an airport, not a streetcar, but housing. So this will be the first test of the mandate on which Quentin Lucas was elected.
816-235-2888 is our phone number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Well, let's walk through some of the components of this tenant's bill of rights, Tara. One is a new landlord-tenant court. What will that be? How does it work?
So it's not a new court. It's rather, again, sort of correcting the balance of power within landlord-tenant court and granting tenants the right to counsel. What we know and what I know—
Is there already a landlord-tenant court in Kansas City?
Yeah. So in Jackson County, where Jackson County. Evictions are processed, right, on the, I think it's the seventh floor of the courthouse, you can go and there's landlord-tenant docket every Thursday. That's where a lot of the eviction cases are heard. Mm-hmm. What I know from my research on evictions is that 99.8% of the time, if an eviction case makes it to court, the landlord wins. And part of that story is about who's represented. 84% of the time, the landlord is represented, and like 2% of the time, the tenant's represented. And representation matters. The tenants who are represented are more successful in their cases, whereas almost everyone else is just evicted.
So who's going to fund? You're talking about attorneys for poor folks when they go before a judge in a landlord-tenant court. Who's going to pay for that?
The city.
The city will. What's that going to cost?
So our estimate is that it's about $850,000 a year, and we're asking
It's not cheap.
It's not cheap. We're asking for a general fund allocation. But, Steve, when we think about all of the numerous other things that the city subsidizes for corporations, out-of-state investors, downtown developers, this really is a drop in the bucket to ensure that there's actual justice in those courts. I don't know if you've ever been down to the landlord-tenant docket, but it's a performance of justice. There's nothing just about what happens there. It's like debt collection. Mm-hmm. You can see hundreds of evictions processed in a matter of hours because of the fact that tenants have no one on their side to help make their case.
Well, why not charge a fee to all the renters when they sign a lease so that all the taxpayers in town don't pay for this?
We don't think that a fee, an additional fee on the backs of our people is the way that this should be funded. Mm-hmm. It should be city responsibility, and it's good housing policy to try to help keep people in their homes.
Again, to be clear, does any other city in the country have something similar to the landlord-tenant court as you're envisioning it, Tara?
Oh, yeah. So this is like one of the sexiest innovations in housing policy right now. New York City has right to counsel as of a couple years ago. San Francisco has right to counsel. And there are a number of other cities that are more like Kansas City that are pursuing this intervention right now. We think this is just, and I want to name, this is just, but it is not the systemic intervention that we need. Mm-hmm. The Office of the Tenant Advocate adds a whole slate of rights to the books that we can then fight about in court. But honestly, just the right to counsel alone is a Band-Aid. That's nothing more than a Band-Aid at the end of a very long injury.
Well, let's talk about the Office of the Tenant Advocate then before this gets away from us. That sounds pretty official. What is it? What does it do?
So the Office of the Tenant Advocate would be charged with educating tenants on their rights, as we talked about before, investigating claims that tenants bring to the city, and then enforcing rights, including but not limited to the power to revoke a landlord's license if they have found that the right has been violated.
That's going to be a bite of the apple for members of the council, isn't it?
Yes, it certainly is. Mm-hmm. And just to be clear, right now, you know, Mayor's team and the law department have our latest drafts of our package. We are still waiting to get back from the law department their version of this stuff. So we are optimistic that what we will see introduced on Thursday, in fact, we expect that what we will see on Thursday is an introduction of a package that looks like what we've drafted. Mm-hmm. And we don't know that for sure yet. So we're seeking this office. And then there's a whole slate of rights, as I said, that this office will now protect, including protections along the lines of the ones that Tiana described against discrimination on source of income, on prior evictions, on past convictions and arrests, and ending discrimination on the basis of gender identity and expression, race, age, marital status, and all the rest.
You mentioned on source of income. What do you mean by that? A landlord couldn't check someone's source of income before they rent?
No, that's actually not what I mean by that. It's a great question. What we know is that a great majority of people who have Section 8 vouchers are discriminated against. Ah. Even when they have the voucher or they have cash in hand, they can't find a place to rent. And really what that is thinly veiled racism, right? People have a certain stigma about Section 8 tenants and they don't want them in their properties. And we're trying to end that. And again, that, like so much of the rest of this, is not unprecedented. Plenty of places across the country have ended source of income discrimination, and Kansas City needs to be the next one.
Okay. Let's go to some phone calls here as we talk about the KC Tenants Bill of Rights, the proposed Bill of Rights going in front of the City Council here in the next few weeks. Again, our number, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Brian from Kansas City, Missouri. Brian, you're on the air.
Thank you, Steve, and I like the topic. I got two questions. One was, how many landlords sit on the Kansas City board that we be voting on this? And the second one is, things like Zillow and these internet real estate companies now are buying up lots of houses. I mean, they'll buy it tomorrow if you want to sell it to them.
Yeah.
And then they turn them into rentals. How does your plan deal with that?
Let's take these one at a time, Brian. We had a little something going on here in the studio. Your first question was, who's going to vote on this, Brian? Do I have that right?
No, I want to know who on the city council is landlords.
Any idea who are members of the council landlords?
Yeah.
We'll find out
here.
That's
what I'm curious about.
Yeah.
All right, thank you. I'm going to
Brian, hang on a second. Just hang on a second. Yeah. Go ahead.
So I actually don't know. That's a great question. My guess is that the majority of the city council are property owners. I know the mayor is a renter himself.
That doesn't make them landlords, though.
That doesn't make them landlords, exactly.
Yeah, right. So we're not really sure. Okay, and Brian, your next question again?
With companies like Zillow and internet real estate companies flooding into towns and just gobbling up property, how does are you able to deal with that through your bill or whatever it is?
Yeah, your housing stock, renters' housing stock, what's happening with that with companies like Zillow coming in?
It's a great question, Brian. Much of the worst practices in the rental market most of it is done by out-of-state corporate landlords, right? It's not actually mostly the local people who have a couple units here and there. And there are a couple ways in which our Bill of Rights addresses that. One is this loss of license to be a landlord if the rights are violated. Currently, our enforcement mechanisms are really limited to fines. And frankly, big corporate landlords don't care about fines. A $1,000 fine means nothing, and they often don't even pay them. So only when you get to the level of threatening a landlord with loss of license will you get a real response from some of these worst landlords that are mostly out of state, mostly corporate.
What would it take to see a landlord lose his or her license? What would it take to get to that point?
As far as we've written the Office of the Tenant Advocate ordinance, it would take repeated or egregious violation of the rights.
Repeated, how many? Or do you have a number attached to it?
We don't have a number attached to it. That would be at the discretion of the people running the office.
Okay. Let's go back to some calls here. Ryan from Grandview. Ryan, you're on Up to Date.
Hi. So I got a question. Does the Bill of Rights include pet policies?
Pet policies.
Like my old apartments, they required only one pet, and if it was a cat, it had to be declawed. which, as most people know now, that's, you know, a kind of an immoral thing to do. So is there anything in the bill that addresses pet policies?
Pet policies, Tara Raghavir, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we have a couple things in the bill that might speak to that. We've got a whole section on fees, unreasonable fees, including, you know, security deposits that are wild, attorneys' fees, and other things like that. I believe that that would be – pet policies would be addressed there. The other thing, though, is
can a landlord assess a pet fee?
Currently, yes. They can do whatever they want.
Yeah.
The other parts that are really relevant
– would the Bill of Rights stop that?
No, not necessarily, but there are protections around unreasonable fees and limits on what those can be. Okay. The thing, though, that is most relevant, I think, is that we are protecting tenants' rights to organize. And when tenants organize, they can actually demand certain provisions from their landlords, right? They can collectively bargain around what the lease looks like to actually protect their interests and their needs and take out some of the stuff that doesn't matter, right? So many of these leases that landlords use are just found through like basic Google search online, and they're not good at all. So one thing we'd love to see as a product of this, this Bill of Rights initiative, is that we develop a model lease along with tenants in the city that protects for things like, you know, good, just pet policies and stuff like that. And we get a core of landlords to actually just start implementing the model lease.
Hmm. Back to some calls here. Let's go to Linda from Topeka. Linda, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about a KC Tenants Bill of Rights. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm so glad to hear you talk about this topic. I'm actually scheduled to go to court tomorrow for a two-day jury trial because last year when I moved out of the rental townhome, the landlord sent me a bill for $10,000 for carpet, paint. I had lived in the property for 4 years.
And so when
I took it, I have a video of it on YouTube of my walkout inspection. And my lawyer told me he's never seen a property in this good of condition. And so it's just nuts. But like what you're saying is my lawyer is working with me because I couldn't afford to pay him, but he's willing to work with me so that we can, you know, we have to go to court. But this whole idea of landlords just deciding to bill their tenants, knowing that the tenants have no recourse or no other protection.
Well, Linda, you just got to move to Kansas City, it sounds like.
I know. Well, I tried to make, you know, talk to the legislature last year about changing some of the laws. Because one of the worst things about this is even if I win the case this week, the most that I can get back is my deposit, which was about $2,000, which was the rent plus a half month
rent. Let me get some. Tiana, what do you make of this, of what Linda's saying here?
It speaks to what we hear every week in our meetings. The opposition, I believe, is going to come anytime you're trying to do something revolutionary, right? We're trying to revolutionize the way policy is made, you know, with the people who are actually impacted at the table.
Right.
I think we should expect opposition. It was always there in every movement.
Let's get one more call here. John from Kansas City, Missouri. John, good morning.
Good morning. I'm glad you took my call. I got a quick question. It's two questions, and I'll get off the phone.
Yeah, make it quick, John.
Is the court for Kansas City proper or just for Jackson County? And two, do tenants that get discriminated or have terrible living conditions, does this Bill of Rights give them a mechanism to get the city involved to say, hey, this is unsuitable habitation and that, you know, you need to fix this before anybody rents again? Thank you.
Yeah, John. Tara?
So the money for right to counsel would be for Kansas City, Missouri, which would include Jackson County, but also, of course, Platt and Clay, which are represented in the metro. And then to your second question, John, that's exactly what the Office of the Tenant Advocate would do.
Okay. We're going to leave our conversation there. Interesting development here with a KC Tenants Bill of Rights. I want to thank Tara Raghavir, Director of KC Tenants. Tiana Codwell is a tenant leader for the organization. Thank you both very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
When we come back from a break, a way to grow Kansas City in a really smart way. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you haven't signed up for my newsletter, you're missing out. Subscribe to Kraske Off Mic at kcur.org/Kraske and get my thoughts and highlights from the week's show in your inbox each Monday. It'll take you about 10 seconds. Go to kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow on the program, it's flu season, and we're out to debunk some of the myths surrounding the flu virus and the flu vaccine. That's on tomorrow's KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the drive in any city is to grow, but grow what and grow how? In Kansas City, Missouri, there's a sense that it's always the big projects that get the attention and the funds, but maybe it's time to change all that. Two people taking a different look at how to make city growth have greater meaning and benefit are here with us today. They are Joe Minicozzi. Am I close?
That's
Minicozzi, principal of Urban 3, located in North Carolina. Joe, nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Chuck Marone is a civil engineer, land use planner, and founder of Strong Towns, based in Brainerd, Minnesota. Chuck, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Delightful. Thank you.
Joe, your company promotes making better decisions about design of place through an understanding of data, economics, and public policy. What data should cities be collecting and analyzing here?
Basically, think of the city as an object that you have costs and you have revenues. So, making sure that they all match up. That are you paying the price of your land use pattern, basically.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of cities don't do that.
Oftentimes, it's siloed out. Think about your tax bill. Are you being taxed on the miles that you drive, the amount of pipe that comes to your house? You're taxed on value on this side of the state border. You're taxed on your earnings tax. But on the Kansas side, you're just paying a property tax. Maybe the sales is in there as a wash. But it's not like when I have this iPhone that I have in my hand, I'm paying for the glass and the plastic and the metal that's in it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm buying that object. Cities should be no different. But you have to see that information to understand what's going on. So we put it on a map so people can see it.
Yeah. Why don't cities do it that way, Chuck?
I do think it is surprising to people that cities don't do it that way. I think a big part of it is that after World War II, our growth model was all about the next big project. How do we get the next thing? And so when you look at the way city government is oriented, we even count things like roads and pipes as assets instead of liabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And so literally, like, the more you can accumulate, the more you can build, the better off your balance sheet is. That's kind of an approach designed to do the next big thing, but not one really designed to maintain and take care of what's already been built.
So you're talking about kind of a user fee system, if you will, Joe, for the way we fund and maintain city services going forward.
I mean, that's a starting point. I don't think there's a magic way to do it. It's more of a thought process. And if what Chuck just talked about, what we see with a lot of cities is that oftentimes they'll go out and bond to pay off roads. Now, that would be the equivalent of you going out and getting a credit card to pay off your mortgage after you've paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
You're just taking down more debt to pay for something that you actually should be able to maintain, right?
Yeah. In fact, I was going to say the two of you will be unveiling a new fiscal assessment of the city this evening at the Plaza location, the Kansas City Public Library, a program that begins at 6:30 this evening. Will people be hearing something radically different than they're used to hearing about Kansas City here, Chuck?
Yes, absolutely. And, you asked this thing about user fees.
Yeah.
I think what we're really talking about is more a balancing between the public obligation and the private wealth that is created.
Mm-hmm.
When you run a mile of street and you run a mile of road, that has an initial cost. And I think we all understand that. We're pretty good about finding ways to pay for that, whether it's from some federal or state grant or the bond market or what have you.
But it's the maintenance going forward.
My gosh, you got to go out and fix that. Now, that street represents an eternal obligation on your community. 25 years from now, you got to go and fix it. 25 years after that, you got to fix it again. You got to go over and over and over. If you're not building enough wealth with that investment, to actually create the tax revenue to fix that, you're just getting poorer with every project that you do.
So again, you're talking about a process whereby someone would, a driver would measure the number of miles they drive on that road and be assessed accordingly?
You know, I think there's different mechanisms.
There's different ways, okay.
Yeah, there's different mechanisms for collecting tax. The reality is, if you don't have enough wealth to tax, however you're going to do it, if there's not enough, you know, what's the old adage about squeezing blood out of a rock or whatever?
Yeah, of a turnip,
you know,
yeah.
Yeah, of a turnip. If you don't have it there, if it's not there, you can't tax it. Whether you're going to tax it with a user fee or a land tax or a property tax, you've got to create enough wealth. And when we step back and look at a city like Kansas City, what you see is that you have a massive amount of capital investment that you spent on infrastructure, and that has all these associated costs with it, and you've just not built enough wealth in the community to sustain that much stuff.
We're overbuilt.
You're overbuilt on the public side and underbuilt on the private side.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So what does this mean then for folks who live on Kansas City's east side that's seen and is a much poorer part of our community than maybe the western side, the Johnson County side? If there isn't much wealth there, how do you then maintain those roads?
Well, again, a lot of this is choice architecture. You know, it's just, are you consciously making a choice of what you're going to – you're all in the community together, mm-hmm. much in the way that we all have families together. That's who we are. So are we making the proper choices to be able to afford the city that we want? And that's ultimately the question we're trying to get you to see is, are you conscious of these choices? So if I tax you on value, right – there's a perverse incentive for me as a developer to build a cheap building. The cheaper the building, the lower the taxes I pay. Mm-hmm. There is absolutely no connection to the cost. So when people see us do the analysis of, like, let's say a Walmart, Walmarts are designed to last 15 years. They consume more police services than they pay in property taxes. So you're essentially out the door, upside down financially with a Walmart. Now, this isn't their fault. Don't hate the player, hate the game. They've figured out the system and the way that they can take the most wealth out of your community.
Right.
But did you choose that? Did you all have a public vote that we're going to go ahead and subsidize that building? No.
Well, how do you begin to change this paradigm here in Kansas City then, Chuck, where we're overbuilt at least on the public side and not so much on the private side?
I think part of it is an awareness that leads to a different emphasis. You started this whole conversation by saying the city wants to grow and we all want to grow. I think that's kind of the common obsession today. How do we get enough? How do we get more growth? What is lost out of that is how productive is that growth? Mm-hmm. Any business in the private sector can grow tomorrow if they're not worried about their solvency a year from now or 2 years from now or 5 years from now. Our cities, as kind of stewards of the public trust, as stewards of, you know, the public wealth, we have an obligation to not just grow, but to grow in a way that actually makes us wealthier, financially more secure, more stable, better off.
Well, you're hitting your finger on one of the big issues in this community, which is we've developed a lot, but we've given so many tax incentives in the course of allowing that development that the public side really hasn't benefited as much as it should.
Well, we were joking.
That's the argument.
Absolutely. We were joking earlier about Applebee's and how Applebee's has gone in for the succession of tax subsidies from both your community and across the river. Kind of playing off each other. Why we would ever subsidize an Applebee's, which is literally like a restaurant that plans to be in a location 10 to 15 years and then move on. The only time you would subsidize something is if it literally is like a century long investment. If it's something that will be there a ridiculously long time with an immense amount of value created that will have all kinds of spinoff effects. And mm-hmm. we just don't. We're so obsessed with the transaction of growth mm-hmm. that we really don't pause to look at the overall impact financially of what that growth is.
So in a perfect world, you two would revolutionize the tax incentive program, the tax abatement program that cities like Kansas City have used for years, tools like TIF, that kind of thing. Am I hearing that right, Joe?
Well, you know, there's good TIF and there's bad TIF. And
a lot of folks think it's all bad.
Well, I think you're at least conscious to it. You know, you're at least seeing it in the newspaper. You're having a discussion. It's being voted on. But again, when you go back to the existing system, there's a faulty system when we're not looking at the investment into the ground and its relationship to the fees that we pay. And mm-hmm. fees, I mean taxes. So, you know, you're an investor in a corporation. You live in one. Mm-hmm. I don't know which part of the community you live in, but you are a taxpayer in both a city and a county.
Mm-hmm.
You're paying revenues to a machine that is a corporate business. It's incorporated. It's got a cash flow. And what Chuck just talked about, the fact that we don't hook in the long-term obligation of that infrastructure, you're not paying attention to like where your money's going. And those are the questions we tend to like focus on TIF and not look at what's our debt ledger or our expenses.
I was going to say, we do look at it in the sense that we just add it to the debt pile.
Right.
That's sort of what we do.
Well, TIF, I think, is one of those flashpoints because it just feels wrong often. Why are we giving subsidies to this? It's one of those things that's easy for us culturally to get our teeth into. But TIF is actually overlaid on this foundation of insolvency. And it's the underlying insolvency that's the problem. Mm-hmm. People who do TIF projects are often looking at it from the government side, from the public official side, as we need this growth because we have all these other problems. And the debate becomes about the TIF. The debate should be all the other problems. Like, why do we have those problems? Well, we have them because the last 5 decades of growth we've had have created massive liabilities, but haven't built enough wealth to actually take care of them. So that neighborhood we look at as prosperous today, the one we look at as successful, the one far out on the edge that we're building with the new luxury homes and the large lots and the cul-de-sac-y streets, those places actually are the most upside down often in terms of revenue. Those are the places with the highest level of cost and the lowest kind of, you can think of it as per foot or per acre tax return.
Mm-hmm.
Those places we're kind of culturally thinking of as successful, when actually we can go some of your poorer neighborhoods in town that have suffered decline and disinvestment, and they're actually generating more revenue on a per acre or per foot basis than you're going to see in the stuff that you're kind of, you know, falling all over yourself to get built today.
Well, isn't part of this just due to competition? The tax rates have stayed low because we're competing against the neighboring communities around us, and we're afraid to raise those rates too high, and because we'll lose chance to grow by attracting these new businesses.
I'm going to quote a very famous woman, Marilyn Minicozzi, my mother, and she said, just because Jimmy jumps off a bridge doesn't mean you have to be that stupid. You know, it's. I think when we look at how we're competing against each other, we need to take a step out and say, is it worth that transactional cost?
Mm-hmm.
And when you say TIF, the Phillips Hotel is a TIF, but that's a building that's been with you since the 1930s, and it took getting it renovated, which is a super expensive thing because it's a high rise.
Right.
But that's latent wealth that's been sitting there since 1930. It's not going to disappear and pull up roots 15 years. Right.
Mm-hmm.
That Walmart does, or the Applebee's headquarters, you know, those pull up roots.
So your point is you want to invest in the long standing establishments as opposed to the fly by night. Well, that's too cheap.
But
the more transient businesses.
Yeah. Again, or be conscious of the fact of what is that investment going to yield over the long haul.
Not only that, but, you know, I think if you think of like two banks competing over a deal. There is a point where a bank, a private sector bank, will walk away from a deal and say, our competitor will do that because we're going to lose money. And like, mm-hmm. we have a obligation to our trustees, to our investors, to our depositors, to not make investments that are bad investments.
So what we're seeing in this community right now, though, is a wholesale reassessment of how we regard these kinds of tools and how much we're going to use them. And I gather, at least on a macro scale, that's a healthy thing, Chuck?
I hope so. I hope that's where we're going. It's really hard, particularly here in the Midwest, because we do have this growth obsession or this growth ethic. Because growth, understand why. Growth solves our problems. When we can experience growth as a city, we get cash flow in the near term. And that is a huge benefit.
But you're saying we're overlooking the long term.
You're overlooking the long term. And so the assessment that we need to do, and part of what Joe's work is going to bring to the table now, and some of the deeper questions that people like the Kaufmans are kind of prompting the community to ask, which I think are really helpful, is what are the long-term financial ramifications of this development pattern, of the decisions we're making, and can we do things differently?
Again, Chuck and Joe will present Smart Growth in Kansas City, How, Where. That's the title of the talk this evening, 6:30 at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. To RSVP, go to kclibrary.org. Let's go to some phone calls here, and Diane from Kansas City, Missouri. Diane, you're on the air.
Hi, this is actually Imani, and my comment is that why is it that we always give incentive money to people outside of the area, like the opportunity zones and tips? If we know small businesses employ more people, why don't we give that same money to people that already live here who can have a job by getting business assistance to not only employ themselves, but also to give their neighbors a job? Why does the money always have to go to somebody outside, like an opportunity zone?
Yeah, I hear you. And Chuck, if I hear you right, that's a point right down your alley here that
Absolutely.
Diane's making.
Our city governments are oriented now today as if they are the bottom of a food chain. And they're designed, they're set up, and this is a post-World War II construct, to look up the food chain and say, what is the stuff we can get out of the state capital, out of Washington, D.C., out of the bond market from private developers to bring capital into our community to create growth? What the caller is saying, and I think the caller is absolutely right, if we reorient our government to actually focus on being of service to people in our neighborhoods, not only are the investments far higher returning, but they actually would benefit people. And I think that's...
But is there a political payoff for taking that leap? Because, you know, taxpayers don't want to acknowledge this in Kansas City, but they oftentimes vote for candidates who have grown the city, who have sponsored big improvements in the infrastructure, that kind of thing, to make the lives of residents better.
I think we have to celebrate these small things. There's certainly, with a strong towns approach, with the approach that Joe is talking about, there's less ribbon cuttings, there's less grand openings, but there's more success, there's more prosperity, there's more wealth. If we can,
but that means reorienting all the voters in the community to look at how they regard success. Now, we've had candidates run for mayor in this town on the idea of lowering debt, and they don't win those races.
It takes a level of literacy, and I think that's one of the things that I appreciate with strong towns, that they're actually building that literacy at a grassroots level. That folks are now less intimidated to look at the actions of their government or how it operates.
Yeah.
And a lot of times when you get into a TIF document, you start reading it, it's full of jargon, it's difficult to understand. And oftentimes those agencies that apply for those are well-heeled and they have the access to ask for that, where mom-and-pop business on Main Street doesn't necessarily have the wherewithal to go sit in government and try to go through a TIFIT system.
Mm-hmm.
But we in government need to understand where the wealth is being created, and the caller is totally right. It's being created by these local entrepreneurs, these small businesses. They don't have time to advocate for themselves because they're too busy keeping the lights on.
Is anybody out there doing it the way you guys recommend?
In spots. I mean, we're all part of this growth machine that was created after World War II. So literally all of our cities in the United States kind of function in a very similar orientation. But you can see places that have gotten very desperate. A place like Detroit, a place like Memphis, a place like Shreveport, where there's a lot of innovation with new approaches that are having a huge positive impact.
Hayes, Kansas.
Yeah, Hayes, Kansas
is
one here locally. I think that the challenge we have is to reorient ourselves before we become so desperate that we don't have other options.
We'll have to leave our conversation there. Again, Chuck and Joe present Smart Growth in Kansas City tonight, 6:30, Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. Joe Minakazi, principal of Urban 3, located in North Carolina. Chuck Marone, a civil engineer, land use planner, and founder of a group called Strong Towns. Thank you both very much. Good luck tonight.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Tomorrow on the show, how to change someone's mind. One philosopher says instead of focusing on facts, we should appeal to human emotion. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. We're getting thumbs up here in the studio. You can follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.